Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we observe Independence Day now with none other than Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much About series, which began in 1990 with his American history classic, Don't Know Much About History. That book has been re-released with an update to bring us up to the present day. So we will talk mostly some recent American history, plus a surprise American history guest reading of the Declaration of Independence, or part of it. Hi, Ken. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning. It is always a great pleasure to be with you, Brian.
Always
Thank you.
My great pleasure to have you. And because the book is formatted as a series of questions and answers about American history, we will do some of the kind of thing we've done before and do this as a Don't Know Much About History quiz.
Okay.
So listeners, if you want to call in and try a question, it's 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Get three in a row right, and we will declare you a Brian Lehrer Show American History Scholar, perfect for 4th of July barbecue bragging rights.
Absolutely. You can brag over the brats.
212-433-WNYC. If you want to give it a shot, 212-433-9692. While the calls are coming in, you've now done Don't Know Much About History, Don't Know Much About Geography. I always expected the third one to be Don't Know Much About the French I Took, but you didn't succumb to that temptation.
Nor do I know what a slide rule is for, but...
And do you know French?
A little.
A little.
That's about it.
That's why you didn't write that book. Then Don't Know Much About the Civil War. Then you left history and went all theological on us with Don't Know Much About the Bible. Was that a difficult turn to make?
No, it actually wasn't. One followed the other, as most of the books generally do, because in reading and writing about the American Civil War, one of the things that I learned early on was that the slavery debate was the first time, at least in American history, that the Bible was used, obviously, to argue both sides of the same question. Lincoln himself would later say this, we both pray to the same God.
And here we still are.
So the fact that the Bible was the most significant book in American history, as well as Western civilization, we should it really gave me the impetus to do it, how the Bible had been used, the fact that it was spoken about by politicians and preachers and pundits, and most people had, of course, never read it for themselves. So it was meant to be a simple, direct explanation of what this book is and how it came to be.
And because explaining the Bible wasn't a big enough task, you did Don't Know Much About the Universe next. Is that a space science book? Can you tell us what the God particle is?
I'm as lost on the God particle as most of the
combining
rest of us.
Combining the two books?
Because what the slide rule is for was, you know, definitely not part of my education. But when you ask big questions about the creation from the Genesis point of view, obviously, again, one book led to another. What's the other perspective on this?
And finally, you wrote Don't Know Much About Mythology, which is the bestseller out of all of those.
Still American history. Don't Know Much About History.
It is.
Has been and is the bedrock of it. And it's, I'd have to say, people always ask, well, which is your favorite? And it's like choosing between my children. But American history is my first love. In fact, I keep on my desk at home, I almost was tempted to bring it in, I have a little wooden revolver that is dated July 1, 2, 3, 1863, that I received as my souvenir of a trip to Gettysburg 49 years ago, just about. My parents' idea of summer vacation was throwing us in the back of the car with a tent, and we'd go on camping trips to places like Gettysburg and Valley Forge or Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York. So from the time I was a kid, I always had the sense that history is something that doesn't happen in books. It's something that real people do in real places. And I keep that little souvenir of that visit to Gettysburg on my desk to remind me of that feeling I had as a 9-year-old standing in that field and sensing and feeling history all around me.
So Ken Davis's Don't Know Much About History came out originally in 1990, And your new final chapter is called From Evil Empire to the Axis of Evil. The evil empire, the Soviet Union, fell just as the ink was drying on the original edition. So this is what's new in the new edition.
Yes,
right?
There had been an intermediate update, but then a couple of years ago, because the changes had been so extraordinary over the last decade, basically dating it from the election of 2000 through the election of Barack Obama, I felt that this decade that we had all lived through was one of the most extraordinary 10 years, 12 years in American history, and I needed to address it because we do forget very quickly.
From September 11th, 2001 to September 15th, 2008, Lehman Brothers Day and beyond, of course, to the election of our first African-American president. All right, let's see if any of the listeners out there can become Brian Lehrer Show, Ken Davis, American History, 4th of July Scholars, for bragging rights at your 4th of July barbecue over the brats, as Ken put it. And nothing says 4th of July like the Jersey Shore, so we'll start with Matt in Point Pleasant. Hi, Matt.
Hey, how are you guys doing, Ken? It's a great honor to speak to you. I really enjoy your work.
Oh, thank you so much.
And just like you, Gettysburg was the impetus for my excitement about history. My mother grew up on the battlefield at the base of Culp's Hill, so I spent quite a bit of time there as a child, and it really got me excited about the past.
Well, people ask me all the time, how do our teachers or parents ask me, how do I get my kids interested? And I say, get them out. Go to these places. There are all, you don't have to go to Gettysburg or Washington, D.C. All history is local, like politics, and you can find something to get the kids fired up.
Absolutely. And history is alive and breathing everywhere we go and every person we meet. So I couldn't agree more.
And Allaire State Park for some of that history, right in that Point Pleasant area, right?
Exactly. We spent quite a bit of time there in the fall. Beautiful area.
So, Matt, since you went to battlefields, maybe you'll be well positioned to answer the first question in this quiz. What was, in a phrase, Operation Desert Storm?
Operation Desert Storm was the United States and many nations' effort to expel the Iraqis from Kuwait.
Very good.
In 1990.
And very specific. Also colloquially known as the First Gulf War.
The First Gulf War under the first President Bush.
No, I would say it was really the Second Gulf War. Of course, you could go back however many thousands of years you want. But it took place just after the Iran-Iraq War had gone on throughout the 80s. And I remember some of the people who opposed that Gulf War, the United States getting involved in it, said, oh, they just had a perfectly good Gulf War. We don't need another one. So
yeah.
In a way, it was the second Gulf War of modern times. Okay, question two, true or false? Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria all sent troops to fight their fellow Arab country, Iraq, in that Operation Desert Storm.
Sent troops or diplomatically supported, did you say? Sent troops?
Troops is the question. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Syria.
I believe that is true.
I'm going to say it's true also, although I haven't looked back at my own book.
My reading of your book tells me that that's true. And that's how much people in the area feared Saddam Hussein's expansionist tendency at that time after he invaded Kuwait. All right,
sure. So he's two for two.
Some religious overtones as well with the Shia Sunni issue.
Yes, though Syria was another Sunni country, another Ba'athist country, and that one surprises me the most looking back at it. All right, question number three, and this is for the bragging rights. In the 1992 presidential still on the war, last one on the war. True or false? The war lasted only 42 days. And so casualties were low all around. 148 Americans killed and about 350 Iraqi soldiers before the surrender. True or false?
Well, clearly there were many, many more Iraqi soldiers killed. I don't know the exact number of Americans killed, unfortunately, but the Iraqi casualties, I'm sure.
And that is exactly right. And you zeroed exactly in on why the answer to that question is false. It's true that the war lasted only 42 days. It's true that only 148 Americans were killed. But Ken, the number that's in your book is an estimated 100,000.
That is the number.
Iraqi troops.
I have the image in my mind of that they called it the mile of the highway of death, I believe was the expression, littered with tanks that had been destroyed all along the road. And one of the other things that the new edition includes is the first President Bush writing with Brent Scowcroft, talking about their decision not to go to Baghdad, which, of course, is
because there was such pressure on them not to do it so as not to slaughter, in effect, so many thousands of sitting duck troops.
And,
along the way.
And the actual invasion of Iraq would have been very, very different from what the UN had called. Remember, this was the true coalition of the willing. This was the United Nations sponsored resolution.
Ken, I mean, Matt, either we hit your sweet spot or you really pay attention, because you are definitely a hands-down Brian Lehrer Show. Ken Davis, 4th of July American History Scholar. Congratulations and thanks for calling in.
Thanks, gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to speak with you, and I hope more people can give to WNYC and NPR. You guys are doing a great service to democracy.
You're very kind. Thank you very much. And New Jersey Public Radio. And when you think about Iraq, I know we think about this from the American perspective most of the time, but that number 100,000 jumps out at me, and it keeps recurring. 100,000 killed in that war. 100,000 is the number that is frequently used. Whether it's really accurate, I don't know, but it's frequently used for the number of Iraqi children that allegedly died as an indirect result of the sanctions by the U.S. against Iran over the next decade that Saddam Hussein didn't take upon himself as limitations, but rather passed those sanctions down to his people and still armed himself to the teeth. And then another 100,000 is the estimated number of Iraqi civilians killed in the war that that the U.S. just left. So, oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness is right, Brian. And we don't always focus on these numbers when we're in the midst of these situations. And numbers are always kind of cold statistics anyway to begin with. We're talking about lives after all. And this is the incredible cost of history and the cost of war that we often don't take into account when we're looking at things, usually from a very American-centric perspective.
And again, that doesn't even include the Iran-Iraq war of the 80s, which they estimate, I think, took about 500,000 lives between the two sides. So poor Iraq is all I have to say about that. This is a 4th of July American History Quiz with Kenneth C. Davis, author of Don't Know Much About History, out in its latest edition to include times from the end of the Cold War up to the present. And our next contestant is Peter in Queens. Hi, Peter. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, thank you, Brian and Kenneth.
And happy 4th. All right.
Happy 4th to you guys.
In the 1992 presidential election, Ken writes, the most indelible image of President Bush, the first President Bush, debating Bill Clinton and Ross Perot was what?
Read my lips.
That is wrong, so I'm going to have to move on. But, Peter, thank you very much. And we're going to go to Danny in Manhattan. Hi, Danny.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
I'm going to ask you the question again and listen carefully. It's that in the 1992 presidential election, Ken writes, the most indelible image of President Bush debating Clinton and Perot
in the televised debate, that's correct,
was what?
Well, the Read My Lips was in 88 because he got called on it. 92, I was 7 years old, so it's going to be a little harder.
They do teach American history in schools.
They do. So I'm gonna take an educated guess. It's a televised image. It must have been something very demonstrative that he was doing. I'm gonna assume it was wagging a finger.
You're pretty wrong, and Danny, thank you. I'm going to move on, and we're going to reveal the answer so we don't get bogged down in this.
Yeah, I can remember it like yesterday, and maybe that's why I wrote this. But checking his watch, he was sitting. They were on stools, and George Bush was asked a question. The other two were answering. George Bush looked down at his watch. It was like he had the limo outside waiting, and he was worried that they were going to leave without him or something. And it just reflected the disconnect that he had with the American people and with that moment. He wished he could have been somewhere else, I think, and that's the moment I chose. So It's a tough one.
And, of course, the Read My Lips, No New Taxes, which Peter referenced, was spoken at the nominating convention in his acceptance speech in 1988, the GOP convention.
That's correct. And one of the reasons that so many of the right of his party deserted him.
All right. We will continue in a minute. And we have a few open lines for more contestants. If you want to take the Brian Lehrer Show, Kenneth C. Davis, Don't Know Much About History, 4th of July quiz, 212-433-WNYC, focusing mostly but not entirely on the 1990s, a lot of the new material in Ken's book from the 90s and the 2000s, 212-433-9692. But when we come back from the break, we're going to play an excerpt of a reading of the Declaration of Independence from a mystery history voice. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Kenneth C. Davis, his classic bestseller, Don't Know Much About History, Everything You Need to Know About American History But Never Learned, out in a new updated edition. I can't say now out in paperback, partly because the book is 20 years old, and I think it was always in paperback, wasn't it?
Well, it first came out in hardcover, and then a paperback a year later.
So the usual thing.
And yeah, it was the usual thing. And this new version also came out in hardcover first and just out in paperback about 2 months ago.
So here is our 4th of July audio quiz, folks. Sit back and listen to this reading of about the first, we'll play about the first minute of the Declaration of Independence and see if you can identify the reader.
When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it.
And all right. And it goes on from there for about another 9 minutes. But Stephen in White Plains, who was that?
That's easy. It's JFK.
It certainly was JFK.
It's Senator JFK. Unbelievable. I discovered that yesterday. The JFK Library posted it, but it was actually produced here at WQXR in 1955, Kennedy reading the entire Declaration of Independence on 4th of July.
That's really incredible. And not to confuse people, this is WNYC, but our sister station, the classical WQXR. I had no idea about that clip. And, you know, I guess everybody's tempted to read the Declaration of Independence if you're a reader or a politician or whatever. I once read the whole thing on the show on the 4th. NPR produces that mashup every year of all the NPR voices. And I'm sure Senator John F. Kennedy from Massachusetts, with larger aspirations, no less, in 1955.
Yeah.
Certainly seemed to get a kick out of it from the sound of his voice.
Yeah, he was certainly enjoying it, and one can certainly hear that he had a great voice. We think of him as the television candidate, but boy, he had a great radio voice as well, that's for sure.
Can we detour, and Stephen, hang on, we'll get to your second question in a minute, but okay. Detour for just a minute into the Declaration of Independence for the holiday. Your section on that is titled, What Exactly Does the Declaration of Independence Say? What did Congress leave out? So we just heard part of what it says, and people know a lot of what it says.
Sure.
What did Congress leave out?
Well, the most important piece that they left out was Thomas Jefferson in his draft left out Thomas Jefferson had included a denunciation of slavery. He actually blamed the King of England for the slave trade and stopping America from halting the slave trade, which was nonsense and propaganda. And it was deleted by the Congress. Jefferson later said it was deleted by Congress in deference to those Southern gentlemen who owned slaves, as well as the Northerners who were making a great deal of money transporting them or otherwise profiting from slavery, which is a reminder that of these 56 men, very few had clean hands when it came to this issue. John Adams was one of the exceptions. He had never owned slaves and was an abolitionist at heart. Adams, by the way, a little 4th of July fun here. Adams wrote to Abigail Adams on July 3rd that July 2nd, 1776, would be a day celebrated with great pomp and parades and bonfires and illuminations, by which he meant fireworks, because that was the day that Congress actually voted in favor of independence. But it was only 2 days later, and Adams couldn't know this, that the Declaration is adopted. That becomes connected immediately in the American mind with independence. One other quick quote from Adams. This he said a little bit later. The history of our revolution will be one continued lie from one end to the other. The essence of the whole will be that Dr. Franklin's electrical rods smote the earth and outsprang General Washington, that Franklin electrified him with his rod, and thenceforward these two conducted all the policies, negotiations, legislatures, and war. He wrote that in 1790 as vice president. His nose was clearly out of joint, he'd already realized that he was going to be sort of taking second-class status among some of the other titans of independence.
Great stuff, and great stuff for the 4th. All right, Steve. And by the way, I wonder what they played, what piece of classical music they played on WQXR right after JFK read the Declaration of Independence. Did they just play Stars and Stripes Forever, or was it something more European and Baroque? I don't know, but it would be curious to find out that little piece of history. All right, Stephen, back to the history quiz, and most of these drawn from the 1990s from material in Don't Know Much About History. Before Monica Lewinsky and Paula Jones, what was the alleged scandal the Republicans kept hammering President Bill Clinton on?
That wasn't the land deal that had something to do with Hillary?
It was a land deal. Can you name the name? One word?
Oh, boy. I don't know if I can come up with the name, but it was a land deal that...
And we're going to give it to you because you got it right.
That's close enough for a cigar.
Also, just as an anecdote on the JFK thing, I was a senior at Clark University in Worcester, Mass. in 58, and JFK, as a senator, came to talk to us at one of our assemblies.
What kind of an impression did he make on you at the time?
I mean, it came with a whole cavalcade, so, you know, here I was, 21 years old. It was pretty impressive. And he was a smooth guy, very smooth.
So can...
The land deal, of course, is Whitewater.
Ultimately,
of course, because it had a water at the end, it became White Watergate, and there was Travelgate, and there were a number of other issues that they were looking into, but it all ultimately got involved with the Lewinsky investigation.
All right, Stephen, that's two. One more, and you will be declared a Brian Lehrer, Ken Davis, American History, 4th of July scholar. And the question is, was Bill Clinton impeached?
I know he wasn't convicted. I think he was impeached.
He was.
He was absolutely impeached.
Impeached.
And only the second president. So that's 3 for 3 again, Brian.
That's 3 for 3. And you get the bragging rights at your barbecue to say that you are a Brian Lehrer Show Kenneth C. Davis, don't know much about history, 4th of July American history scholar. Steve, thanks a lot for playing.
And just
to you every day, Brian, by the way.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate
it. And just to round that out, we should say, of course, the second president to be impeached after Andrew Johnson, Lincoln's successor, and also, like Johnson, acquitted in the Senate. And the House impeaches, the Senate tries.
And people get this wrong all the time. Sometimes I mention this history on the air when it's relevant to something in the news, and I say casually, well, Bill Clinton was impeached, yada, 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 and people write in and people call up and they're all upset. No, Clinton wasn't impeached. And what they mean is he wasn't removed from office.
That's correct.
But he was impeached because that is the indictment.
That's right.
From
it's
the House of Representatives.
It's a two-step process. And, of course, the other president threatened with impeachment, of course, it was Richard Nixon, who resigned before he could be impeached, but he certainly would have been.
And you write about how the founding fathers vigorously debated what the impeachment rules should be. What were the fault lines in that debate?
Well, Benjamin Franklin had started this whole process off when he suggested, and of course we're talking about creating the presidency in 1787, which is the subject of the next Don't Know Much About book in September, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Benjamin Franklin worried that if we don't have a way to get rid of the executive, the only recourse we'd have would be assassination. He actually said that in the debates. And there was a lot of back and forth about how the president should be removed, what should be the, and they did come up with these phrases, of course, treason and high crimes and misdemeanors is, of course, the phrase that was used in the Constitution and has been debated ever since, like so many other things in the Constitution, because it's not literally defined. What are high crimes and misdemeanors? Gerald Ford famously said, whatever the House of Representatives thinks they are.
Because it's political. It's not legal.
It is a political political act.
Eric in Brick, you ready for some questions?
Absolutely.
All right. I just spent the weekend in Brick, as a matter of fact, with some friends. Ate at one of your finest establishments, the Brick Diner on Route 70.
So, oh, there you go.
Saw the Lakewood Blue Claws game Saturday night. But anyway, we're in the impeachment of Bill Clinton. On the day of Clinton's impeachment vote, Republican Congressman Robert Livingston, who was about to replace Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House, shocked the country by resigning himself. Why did Livingston resign?
I don't remember that one. I knew all those other questions. I'm going to say it was a sex scandal.
Well,
that's close enough to we'll give it to you. It's whenever you're in doubt, say sex scandal in politics.
Right,
you know
exactly.
He also admitted to having a relationship outside of his marriage. This was, of course, when
several.
I believe Hustler magazine put up a reward for information about other politicians. And
that was the
end of Robert Livingston.
He couldn't quite be leading the charge because that distinction between this is about sex or this is about lying under oath was lost on a lot of people. Okay, so that's one right. Another question, right from Don't Know Much About History, you frame a section of the book this way. What was irrational exuberance? And I'll add, who became famous for using that phrase, Eric?
Irrational exuberance. Something with the economy, Alan Greenspan?
That's a good guess, but you're absolutely right. It wasn't he did not coin the phrase, but used it most memorably, I believe, in Senate testimony.
And for extra credit, though it's not your third question that gives you the bragging rights, what was the aspect of the economy that he was describing with the phrase irrational exuberance?
All the dot-com stocks and all that, the startups.
It was the explosiveness of the stock market.
The market in general,
but certainly the dot-com was playing into it at that time.
At that time in, what was it, 96?
That would have been around 96.
I think it was 96. I think your section on Greenspan is fascinating, by the way. You say the first President Bush largely blames Greenspan for his not being elected. How come? No, let's ask Eric and Brick. Eric, How come? Why did the first President Bush largely blame Alan Greenspan for his not being reelected?
Probably because it took some time for the policies to work to make the economy turn around.
Ding, ding, ding. I think that's qualifies.
It's very close, but specifically he was keeping interest rates very high, which was a follow-on to the Volcker era. Paul Volcker keeping, as the chairman of the Fed, keeping the interest rates high. Greenspan did as well. And George Bush, really the first, George Bush felt that if he had brought the interest rates down sooner, the economy could have come out of recession sooner and he might have been reelected.
But Greenspan didn't want to overheat the economy too fast. He was worried about inflation. And so he kept the interest rates at a certain higher level than Bush might have liked, but it did help. He was still lowering them from the 80s when they were so crazy high.
That's correct.
Though that worked too in the 80s, and you go into that in the book. The Volcker high interest rates helped, remember Gerald Ford, whip inflation now.
Win buttons.
But inflation continued through the Carter years, and it was when Volcker, as Fed chairman, put the interest rates such that you could get CDs in those days for like 14%.
We were just reflecting that on that off air. I mean, yes, children, once upon a time, a CD could pay 12 to 14%.
I think we pay the bank to store our money in the vault or not lend it to aspiring homeowners. But yeah, it took some time for the Greenspan policy to work longer than the quick injection that President Bush had been hoping for. So, Eric, I hope you get a nice 4th of July barbecue on the water there somewhere. And you are a Brian Lehrer Show, Ken Davis, 4th of July American History Scholar.
All right. Excellent.
Thank you very much. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, guys.
And
gloat happily.
That's right. Okay. Let's see. Our time is soon to run out, but I think we can do another one. How about Linnell in Brooklyn? Linnell, hi.
Hi.
So we are in Alan Greenspan mode here.
Okay.
And the question is, what originally made Greenspan a rock star as chairman of the Fed? His handling of what crisis?
Oh, boy.
It is a hard one. There was a crisis. There was no irrational exuberance on the day that we have in mind that started the crisis. That's all the clues I can give you. Take a guess?
Social Security? I don't know.
No, sorry, Linnell. Thanks for trying. Greg in Hoboken, we're going to try that same question on you before we retire it. Did you hear the question?
No, I didn't.
All right. What originally made Greenspan a rock star, and it is a hard one, as chairman of the Fed, his handling of what crisis?
I'm thinking.
Okay. You're still thinking.
High interest rates? No, probably not.
No, not high.
Greg, thanks.
We're going to retire
put them out of
one.
Their misery. It was what was then called the Asian contagion. We forget the number of crises that we've been through.
Well, now I was actually thinking of something else that was before the Asian contagion, which came later, and it was the stock market crash of 1987, where the Dow started at about 2,500 that day, and it went down 500 points. Today, if the stock market goes down 500 points, we say, oh, my God, if the Dow does. And it's around 12,000, 13,000. It was 2,500.
Yeah.
And it lost, 20% of its value.
This was one of the real first shocks in what had been a fairly boom time for the stock market, and when you can count forward from there to the other than the dot-com boom and then the 9/11 loss. But yeah, this was where Greenspan stepped in, and there were phone calls fast and furious overnights that once again had the banking system on the verge of we're going to see a lot of these go down, and we've seen that time and time again since, but this was the first big one, and this put Alan Greenspan front and center in the public eye.
We only have time for one more question, so Brian in Valley Cottage will get the opportunity to be one-third of a Brian Lehrer Show 4th of July American History Scholar, but it's one-third out of one-third, so you could still say you got 100. This is our kicker question on the Alan Greenspan sequence. Brian, you there?
Hello.
Hi, Brian. The question is, who is Alan Greenspan's wife?
Andrea Mitchell.
Is right.
We ended on a celebrity note. How could we talk about history without ending up on a celebrity note? So.
All right, and there we go. Brian, thank you very much. And Ken Davis, thank you very much. This has been such great fun, as it always is when you come on.
I love to be here, and now we can all go pursue happiness.
Absolutely. If happiness is hot dogs or tofu dogs or whatever your thing is, while watching the fireworks over the Hudson River or on television.
Or burning your feet on the sands at Coney Island.
Don't know much about history. Everything you need to know about American history, but never learned, in paperback, updated to the present. Ken, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian. Happy 4th, everybody.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And still to come, we will meet the director and two members of the Young People's Chorus of New York City, a great institution, and about to take their talents to China. Stay tuned.